Welcome back. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. It can be argued that America's current divisiveness is the worst it's been since the Civil War. Red versus blue states, 99% versus the 1%, and yes, black versus white. What will it take to get America to live up to its potential? Comedian, political commentator, actor, and author D.L. Hughley believes open and honest dialogue, no matter how painful or uncomfortable, is the crucial step. In his book, I Want You to Shut the Bleep Up, How the Audacity of Dopes is Ruining America, written with Michael Malice and published by Crown Archetype, D.L. Hughley pushes us to open our mouths and start talking. So to begin the conversation, he's with us today. Welcome.
Yeah, happy Chick-fil-A Day.
Well, let's start there.
Yeah, like
what do you think about that?
Like, America needs another reason to eat fatty foods. Like, we need another reason. You'll never see Broccoli Appreciation Day. That'll never happen. Yeah, but the good thing about it is that if conservatives eat enough Chick-fil-A, then that Obamacare plan won't look so bad, will it?
I guess not. Were you at one today?
No. I think I dig the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich, but I hate their stance on gay marriage. So my compromise is that I had the chicken without the bun. That's the best I could do.
So let's start with the title a little bit. I don't have a problem with it, but over the last 24 hours, I know Barbara Walters and a lot of people giving you a lot of grief about it. What's the real thinking behind that?
Well, I think obviously whenever somebody's saying something that you don't agree with or that is in opposition to your viewpoint, you shout at the TV, why don't you shut the, you know, like when you're at home in the privacy.
Right.
There are people that gall you that much. And I think that it was kind of in that spirit that we used the title.
Let's just talk about some news items that
are,
you know, play toss up here.
Sure.
Mitt Romney's a couple of missteps in Europe. What's your take on
that? I think when you are considered boring and arrogant by the English who invented boring and arrogant, then you're pretty boring. I mean, this cat couldn't go to Poland and relate to those white people. I think Mitt Romney is a symptom of all that has plagued this problem. And I've met him before, not a particularly bad man, but an out of touch man. And a man who feels like he was groomed to be president. He has the look, he has the family, he has the pedigree. So naturally, it's an ascension that he probably feels like he should elevate to. But I just don't think he has. My sole problem is, why would a man who's profited from the way things are, and who's seeing the people around him profit from the way things are, have any interest in changing the way things are? That's just, like, what interest would he have in doing that? And that's just kind of, I just don't understand what logic he would use to change what he sees as a structure that has benefited him and the people around him.
You're equal with your commentary. You've been somewhat harsh on the president as well. How have you been most disappointed by Barack Obama?
I thought that one of the things that was the most obvious is I thought that I would like more Wesley Snipes than Carlton Banks, but I think legislatively I was disappointed when he wasn't as stern with the banking institutions as he was with the automotive institutions. I thought that they were really kind of driving, the driving force and having, they were pivotal in our economy doing what it did. And I thought that he was fairly light-handed with him. And then the way that he kind of would let Republicans just bully him was just hard to take I blame liberals as much as I do him. I think that in order to be great, you have to be pushed to it. Like, every great athlete, every great student, every great anything was pushed to it by somebody who loved them. Not his critics, but somebody who loved them. A coach, a mother, a father. And people that love you expect more from you. And oftentimes that looks like they don't like you or they are being extra hard on you. That greatness is never coddled. It's pushed. And I think liberals have been kind of lax in doing that.
The greatest accomplishment of this current president? What do you think that's been?
Obviously healthcare. Obviously healthcare.
You're all behind it.
I don't think anything should be my problem is that people get more angry at trying to save a life than they do at taking them. If we had, I've never seen them say we don't have money for war, but I've always seen them say we don't have money for education or we don't have money to build anything. I thought the bravest thing I've ever seen any president do was this healthcare battle, which cost him politically, everything, the pendulum has swung the other way, and I'm enamored by his deftness at being able to get it done, and it was brave. It was brave. He's bet the farm on it.
You don't shy away from talking about race. You write in your new book that conservatives treat Obama harshly because he's black, and that some liberals handle him with kid gloves because he's black. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, I think that some of the animus behind, and I want to be careful not to paint everybody with one broad brush, but I think that obviously some of the animus that has been, you've never seen anybody do some things they've done to anybody, any president in our history, from calling him a liar to a thief to a Muslim to a terrorist to un-American to not being born here, even the way that the current, from Sununu to Romney now are, oh, he's un-American, I wish he learned that. And I think that there is obviously a way to portray him as other. And I think that people generally were more comfortable with race. It just looks different when that person now is the leader of the free world. You know, in theory, it's great, but when that person is either dating your daughter or the leader of the free world, that becomes different. I really do. And I think that it has driven some people insane. And I think that liberals always, he'll get better if he gets a second term. Presidents run the first time for election, second time for history. That's just kind of what happens. And I just think that everybody kind of, I feel like conservatives thought they were going to get an angry black dude, and liberals hope they would.
You wrote in your book that Clinton is actually more black than Obama.
I think he's had more experiences that I have. I would obviously I was being tongue in cheek, but I think that he's had more experiences that, from the way he was raised to his diet to the fact that he got fired from a job and still came back to work.
The next day.
like nothing had ever happened. But I think he is more comfortable around lots of black people than President Obama seems to be. Like, he's more comfortable.
I'm Elliot Forrest with D.L. Hughley. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. The new book is called I Want You to Shut the Blank Up. You were bullied as a kid, and you have a very interesting take on that. First of all, how were you bullied?
Well, beaten up, slapped around. Obviously, I grew up where
physically,
I
was. Physically, mentally, obviously. Verbally?
Mentally was something I didn't learn about until later on, obviously. But I was slapped around, beaten up, lunch money taken away from me, stitches,
Is this all peers, or is this some family members, too?
Well, it had happened a lot, but specifically, there was a cat in my neighborhood, and I allude to this in the book, who he was 6-7 years older than me. He was older than me, significantly older than me, and he would it would separate my shoulders, slap me around, put me in high. He's done a bunch of stuff. And I knew that I had to fight. My father there was never sympathy. It's like, you're going to fight till you win. And
that was the advice?
I would say the people that grew up when I grew up, there was never, there was never a coddling. And there was always,
let's sit down, let's discuss it.
And how many times have you ever seen that work? Bullies by nature are very unreasonable people. And so they respond to one thing, and that's force. They have to believe that everything in nature seeks the path of least resistance. And I think that bullies are no different than a lion who only mess with the sick and the infirm and the weak. And I think one day you're going to have to fight regardless. And I learned.
So did you not fight for a long time, or did you put it?
I didn't fight for a long time. I was horrified of them. Horrified. And then when I wasn't, and when I started to fight back, and when I started to get my licks in, then all of a sudden he knew and I knew it wasn't going to be easy. I didn't have to win, but people have to know it's not going to be easy. And I think there's no way to kind of legislate around that. That one day you will have to stand on your own two feet, be it verbally, physically, emotionally, and to plant your feet and to fight for what you believe in.
Do you believe this was actually good for you?
I believe that behind every cloud there's a silver lining. I don't think that. To say that it was good for me would be like wearing tight shoes so you feel good when you take them off. I don't think that.
You're not glad it happened.
No, I'm certainly not glad it happened. But I understand that it does happen, and I understand that it is a horrible rite of passage, particularly in America, where we seem to love violence so much. And love, bravado and macho kind of, So I think that it is, unfortunately, it's American as American as apple pie.
The reason I ask whether you are glad it happened is that I'd read that you disagree with the current anti-bullying campaign that's going on.
They don't work.
Why is that?
I think that you can't. First off, obviously there's going to be, even if you are successful in legislating a very small piece of it, there's going to be somebody who takes it to the extreme, and some kid is, you know, put in jail for doing, you know, something that people, you know, this is going to be a bit of an overreach. And the other thing is that I don't know how you, what level can you not say certain things? Can you, if you, I just don't know at what level it becomes actionable.
You extrapolate from that you don't think Barack Obama was ever bullied.
No.
What do you mean by that?
I could tell by the way that, remember when Joe Wilson called him a liar?
During what? State of the Union address, right?
I believe if he had been bullied, he'd have recognized who that was right away. And I think that his presidency would be different had he responded like a man who'd been bullied before. I think.
How would have he responded?
I think if he'd have said, you don't have to like me, but I'm the duly elected president of the United States of America. You don't have to like me, but you have to respect this office. Remove him from the premises. I think it would have been a different presidency. Do you remember after that, all bets were off? They were like, that's the moment when you know either this bully's going to take my lunch money or I'm going to stop him. And they've been eating his lunch, I think, to a greater or lesser degree ever since.
You actually write about the distinction between disrespect and disagreement.
Certainly.
Talk about that.
I think that there is a... when people feel superior to you for some reason, they think that your opinion, or just like even the way your opinions or your viewpoints or the way that you come about reasoning is flawed, and they feel like they can be disrespectful because you have no value. There is a, when I argue, when I am having a conversation with my children, were very young, I still had to respect that they had. But whatever opinion they had, obviously tie goes to the runner, and mine is going to matter at on some levels more. But I think there is no, when you have first to have a conversation, first you have to respect the person. And I think people tend to, if you don't agree with them, believe that your opinion is flawed, and that they don't, by that logic, they don't have to respect you.
Let's talk about your kids. How many do you have?
Three.
And your son particularly, you write quite movingly about your son,
yes.
Kyle.
Yes.
That he has, that he's autistic.
Yes.
How much of a challenge was that?
It wasn't, my wife would probably see it different, but I saw, I looked at it from a kind of, it was a multi-layer for me. He was a, he had obviously had a developmental problem. He was at that time we were living in a black community, which would have been, I thought, tough for him to, you know, kind of navigate through. He's a young black male who already would have a certain amount of animus to deal with anyway as a young black male. So I thought there wasn't just one specific thing. I think my wife looked at it more from his. And I knew that I would have, that autistic boy would have to become an autistic black male. So it was those things that, from that prism, I had to navigate through all that kind of stuff. But it was, he's the best human being I've ever met.
And those father and son talks, were those something you look forward to?
He's very literal. Anybody who has a son with Asperger's knows they're very literal. So it was challenging, you know, trying to be tongue-in-cheek with a guy who only got the tongue part. So, but he is, it was... Because, you know, he would peak, plateau, sometimes regress. So it was just cyclical, and it was really kind of tough to almost think they got it. My son was like my golf game. Like, just when I thought I got it, I'm a million miles away from where I thought I should be. But he has blossomed into the most humane person I've ever met. I don't know men that I respect as much as I do this young. He is the most loving human being I've ever met, and I think he gets more of that from his mother, but the most doggedly determined man I know, and I think he got that from me. That makes me proud.
You gave the commencement speech
at his graduation.
When he graduated from college.
Yes.
That must have been a challenge.
It was.
I gave one once, and yeah. I said yes right away to giving the speech, and then it was like, now I got to write it and deliver it. What did you think?
I felt like a bit of a hypocrite because I've never graduated from college, never even graduated from high school. So I didn't want to sit up and talk to people who had accomplished something that I never had and pretend and you know, wax poetic about what an education meant. And he said, Dad, it'll mean a lot to me, and it'll be a chance for us to actually graduate together. And so obviously I did it. And When I was on stage, I got choked up because my son is the very first male in my entire family ever to receive a college degree. Ever.
Is that right?
Oh, ever.
Ever.
Ever. In my entire family, both sides, he's the first male in my family.
There must have been a lot of crying in the family.
Oh, I was tears were in my eyes until I realized that 5 minutes before he got his degree, I got mine. So he is actually the second person to ever get. That actually was the last. I actually went, why am I crying? I beat him.
And you let him know that.
And absolutely.
I'm speaking with comedian and political commentator D.L. Hughley about his book, I Want You to Shut the Bleep Up, How the Audacity of Dopes is Ruining America. It's published by Crown Archetype, and we'll be back in a moment after this break. Welcome back. Elliot Forrest here, so happily sitting in for Leonard Lopate. The guest is D.L. Hughley, comedian, commentator. His new book is I Want You to Shut the F Up. Let's talk a little bit about your comedy upbringing. When did you first do stand-up?
The very first time was 1989, and it was, I got on stage. I used to, you know, talk stuff in the barbershop, and these cats, you know, they used to be concert. They were promoters. They cut hair. They sold weed. They, you know, so it was always. And so they were doing a concert, and they said, if you think you're so funny, you know, sit in this barbershop, get on stage. And the minute I picked up a microphone, I knew that I would love it for the rest of my life.
And what club was that?
It was a club called The Total Experience, which was a black disco on Crenshaw Boulevard in Los Angeles. Doesn't exist anymore, but it was. And it was, they did venues and
did you kill the first time?
No, not at all.
But you still thought, this is for me?
Yeah. It felt instantly right, like I was saying hello to an old friend. And I never, even from that time to this, it's never been, their response to me has never been as important as my feeling on stage to me.
And when did you know you had an audience first in the palm of your hand is working?
I don't think I've ever known. I think I just have never thought that way. I've always thought, if I do it right, then I get to do it again. I've been at it 27 years.
But there is that moment where you plan, you deliver, you set up, you say it, and then that roar back to you must be addictive.
It is. But let's be realistic. People laugh at so many things you can never tell what it is.
They come to laugh.
You're like, I don't get it.
And were there some comic heroes? There some people that you...
Carlin Pryor, Gregory, Red Fox, you know, Lenny Bruce, cats, you know, that I thought painted a picture of the world. I thought that, and from even a time when I wasn't even remotely, I was a kid, and I always knew that these cats, when we had to sneak to listen to their records,
something's wrong.
Yeah. I always knew that they were saying something that was right, even though I wasn't supposed to hear all of it. I knew that they were doing something that was important, and even though I didn't get all the jokes and I knew that at the core they were holding a mirror up to us.
And was it all jokes, or were you always talking social commentary from the beginning?
I think I've never intentionally went and thought that I would, you know, take it. What I've tried to do is to say what I see, and so many things just kind of, from a social realm imprint itself in when I'm writing, that it may come off like a social commentary, but it's just that some of the things that have happened socially are so stark that I can't help but talk about them.
And Lenny Bruce, was he an inspiration for you?
At first, and then I thought he started to dig and be addicted to the controversy instead of the comedy. That's kind of where you want to, you know, that's a cautionary tale.
Let's talk about guns a little bit. You own many.
Many.
Yeah.
I was arrested here in 1996 for having a gun, or 1998 for having a gun in New York.
You had it illegally?
No, it was legal when I left California, but at that time, I left California, it was registered and legal. I landed in New York, I was a criminal. So
you had it on a plane.
But it checked in my luggage. Uh-huh. But just having a gun at that time was illegal. I used to play gigs. I would always have a gun. I had large amounts of cash on me. I played in Westchester, coming through JFK. The bellman ran through security, and I was telling him I had to go register, but he ran through. At that time, they had the metal detectors. You had to go through the metal detector before you came into the terminal. And So I was arrested and got a cat named Murray Richmond, and it was I paid him $30,000 and had and basically got the case dismissed. But it was I've always had guns.
Are you packing heat right now?
No.
Okay. Good. It's really none of my business.
No.
Thought I'd ask.
funny. No, I'm not.
But why? Why do you own them?
I have, in my experience, they are tools. Now I don't advocate, I believe I treat them responsibly, and I am not for more gun laws. I think that enforcing the ones we have would be nice. I'm also adamantly opposed to having high capacity magazines that exist.
So you draw a line somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. I think that more than anything else, I think what this country is suffering from is an addiction to violence.
You mentioned that earlier. Tie that together for us.
Well, try to send a man to the hospital, be president and legislate sending a man, being able to provide health care for somebody. Everybody says it's the end of society as we know it, but start a war where you kill a couple hundred thousand innocent people and no one says anything. If we cared, we would care that 10,000 people every year are murdered by guns. We would care, but we don't. If it was aspirin or steroids or Tylenol or texting or anything else, we'd do something about it. We don't.
But you're against more gun control.
Because gun control is always going to be kind of be the red herring that holds up the argument. I don't think telling people that they can, there's always going to be a way that somebody who wants to do harm can. I am opposed to, like I said, high capacity magazines and these weapons of mass of urban mass destruction. But I am also aware that more than anything else, the way that we view guns, the way that we are so attached to violence is, I think, going to be. I mean, look at all the things that have happened where we just haven't done anything about it. You can legislate gun laws all day long. They just when we had assault weapons off the street, I don't know that it was markedly different than it is now. I don't know that if having gun bans is going to change our affinity for violence.
This tragic shooting in Aurora, Colorado, we all talk about it. You know, it raises the issue of gun violence. And then, you know, someone will say, if more people in that theater had a gun that
day. I actually wrote a blog that ran in Huffington Post on the 30th, and it's called Morning in America. And I would venture to say, based on the fact that Colorado has pretty lax carry laws, that and Aurora is part of Aurora, is at least the hood. Is an urban center. I bet that somebody in that theater had a gun. I bet they did. I bet that somebody in Arizona had a gun. We know Fort Hood, everybody had a gun. But the scenario where the lone hero stands up and shoots it out with a guy who's got on Kevlar and, you know, and an assault weapon, where that happens, is the movie you came to see, not the one that you actually had. The police waited till he ran out of bullets before they... You never see that. They either kill themselves or run out of bullets. More guns certainly don't make us safer. I'm not advocating that either. I think I'm trying to be more pragmatic with the realization that you'll never get people to get rid of their guns. I think it is two pronged. I think we shouldn't have so many. We shouldn't have any the ability for anybody that isn't specifically in the military to have these kind of weapons. And we should address the fact that we are so attached to violence.
Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lope. D.L. Hughley's new book, As I Want You to Shut the Bleep Up. You had said at one point that you actually trust guns more than the police.
Sure.
What do you mean by that?
I've never once in all of my experiences seen the police get there in time to do anything but draw a line around somebody I loved or carry somebody away.
Always too late.
And I don't know that... To say that the police response time where I grew up was slow, it would be insulting to slow. So, and I think that there is proactive policing is not, I think, practiced in urban settings. And that kind of formed my opinion and the way I interact even now with police. I never have seen them get there in time to do anything.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. I wanted to touch on the Trayvon Martin case.
Sure.
And also, this was new to me. The talk. the idea of the talk that, black fathers particularly or black parents give their kids. Describe what that is.
Well, when you tell them how to act in society, when you tell them what could get them killed. Now, it's I allude to it in the book. I actually wrote a piece, again, for the Post, where I wrote a letter to Trayvon Martin and then one called Boogeyman 3.0. The most fearful thing and the scariest thing for a black parent is to have a black child, a black male child. And it isn't. I think we all have fear that someone may cause harm to our children. But generally, that fear is relegated to what somebody does to your children. But ours.
And what do you say?
Ours is specific to the fear of my child could cause them to hurt them. The fear of Trayvon Martin caused them, and fear of a black male child made society think it was okay to. Like, I remember having an argument with Geraldo, and he said, well, he had a hoodie on. It's the hoodie. I mean, I remember when it was black people that were scared of people wearing hoods. I actually remember that. But I think that when you have to tell your child how to act when the police stop them, how to act in society so they don't not viewed as a threat, how to speak, how to walk, I think that it tells you, part may be paranoia, but also it's practical.
I keep thinking we're past that, no?
I think that that's I don't know that society has quite an idea what people deal with. And all these things kind of shock people all the time. And that's amazing to me. Like, we think we're so, we always look for signs of our evolution and how far we've come. But we always, and then that's always kind of all in. We believe it, we're this far, we've evolved. And then something like Trayvon Martin happens, and then we realize just how far we have to go. I mean, let's not be foolish. Black males kill black males all over the country, and nobody, it doesn't have this level of animus. But there obviously has to be something done about the way we approach it.
Thoroughly enjoyed this. I've been speaking with comedian and political commentator D.L. Hughley about his book, I Want You to Shut the Bleep Up, How the Audacity of Dopes is Ruining America, published by Crown Archetype. D.L., thank you so much
for
joining us today.
Had a good time. Thank you.
It was fun.
Thank you.